Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. In 1944, a B-25 Mitchell flown by Ira Barnett took off from an airfield in Papua New Guinea on a regular mission to harry any Japanese shipping that they came across. Attacking a barge, the Japanese managed to get some lucky shots in on Ira's plane. Attempting to nurse the Mitchell back to base, it became obvious to the crew that they weren't going to make it and will be forced to make an emergency landing in a swamp. In this episode, we're looking at the ordeal the crew went through and the rescue mission that was launched in an attempt to bring the boys back home. I'm joined by Bas Kruger. Bas is an aviation historian and author of Case, which recounts the story and Bas's own attempts to locate the B-25 over 70 years later. But before we get to that, it's a big thank you to all those who already support the podcast and have become patrons. A dollar or so from people like you, loyal listener, help me find the time to put the show together. Now you can find out more at patreon.com/WW2podcast. I really do value your support, and when possible, I do try to make available extra bits and bobs exclusive for patrons. A bit more World War II chat, as it were. So that's patreon.com/WW2podcast. So we're in New Guinea, Baz, with the Air Force, US Air Force, in the summer of 1944. Shall we set the scene? How is the war in the Pacific at this time for Ira and the other air crews?
Yeah, that's really different from Europe, of course. Not bombing from great height, no strategic targets, no cities to bomb, no factories or whatsoever. So it's more or less a tactical air war, bombing Japanese positions, ships, airfields, things like that. And of course, trying to strangle them, their logistics, so hit shipping and all kinds of stuff like that. And the other thing is having air superiority, of course, because MacArthur can only advance if he has an air umbrella over his troops. And because there's a lot of invasions, I mean, in 1944, they did, I think, some 10 to 15 amphibious invasions, and they were building bases after that. So they were also gathering a lot of intelligence, so photo reconnaissance, sending in teams on the ground to take soil samples to see if you can build an air base or a port somewhere. Because all the information on the country, on New Guinea, both Papua New Guinea and Dutch New Guinea, was very sketchy. It was hardly explored before the war, and they never thought they would fight a war there, neither the Japanese nor the Allies. So that's I think, the scene for the air war. Tactical bombing, air-to-air combat a little bit. In 44, the Japanese were beaten in that field, and intelligence, photo ops, and air sea rescue. A lot of air sea rescue missions.
Yeah, well, it's a big theatre. So we're following the 418th. It's a night fighter squadron, isn't it? So they're in New Guinea. Do they come straight to the Pacific? What's the New Guinea like for these flyers?
Yeah, they were trained in Florida. There were a bunch of night fighter squadrons trained there. And they were sent out in late 1943, first to Port Moresby and the eastern part of Papua New Guinea. And their main task there was to fight the washing machine Charlie, the Japanese night intruders, just being bothersome over the airfields, dropping a bomb here and a bomb there. So they were patrolling against them. But you have to imagine, there's no navigational aids there. There are no lighthouses, no cities, no recognizable structures on the ground. So night flying, and in the tropical weather during the night, that must have been scary stuff to do. And that's where they started at the end of 1943, and then moving up with the American advance, first to, I think, Ley, and then to Hollandia, and finally they head up to the Philippines.
I'm right in saying they're meant to get Black Widows, but they get the B-25 Mitchell. So So the what do the crews think? They're offered a Ferrari and they get a sort of a Model T Ford.
Yeah, exactly. They were flying the P-70, the night fighter variant of the A-20 light attack bomber, and they were promised the P-61s. And they had even arrived in Australia, and they sent down a team to I think to Brisbane to assemble them and to bring them over to New Guinea. But in the meantime, 5th Air Force decided that they had to switch over to some old leftover B-25s. It's the B-25H model, the one with a 75 millimeter cannon in it, but that has been taken out. So yeah, they get the hand-me-downs of the other squadrons. But what I read from their squadron logbook is that when they really started operating them, well, they liked it. It was offensive warfare. They were flying during daylight hours. And not just like night fighters sitting there waiting till some Japanese show up. So they really liked the hunting for Japanese shipping and attacking airfields and small harbors and things like that. It was dangerous, not very dangerous, but was dangerous. But yeah, what kind of flying in New Guinea was not dangerous? So they liked it.
You kind of think that it is sort of playing second fiddle to Europe, isn't it? When they don't get the best planes, they're not in great barracks, they're living in makeshift ad hoc camps, having to put up with fighting hot, damp, malaria. It's a very rough existence for these crews.
Yeah. And all over the army, not just the Air Force guys, but also in the army. More of them were taken to hospital for illness, for malaria and for scrub typhus and things like that than they were wounded by enemy fire or something like that. There were also a lot of suicides there in New Guinea. A lot of soldiers killed themselves. They couldn't stand the humidity, the heat, the boredom, the filth, things like that. That's also what struck me when reading up on this story.
So we're looking at Ira
Barnett
and his crew. So the 27th of July 44, they take off in their what was their mission that day?
But they had an armed reconnaissance mission, flying over the Bird's Head Peninsula of Dutch New Guinea. And trying to intercept any Japanese shipping, trying to bring in supplies for the garrisons in still active in New Guinea. MacArthur had bypassed a number of big Japanese garrisons, and if you cut off their supplies, their food, their fuel, their ammunition, well, they can't do much harm. I think I called it in the book virtual island hopping, because he was not really island hopping, but he was in Wewak in Papua New Guinea. He left a huge Japanese garrison of 40,000 men. They were sitting there up till the end of the war, being dangerous in that spot, but not being able to leave there. So they were flying around the coast of the Bird's Head Peninsula looking for Japanese shipping, and they found one of those barges.
A barge doesn't sound too much of a threat. So, how do they go about attacking a barge? Because I don't suppose the Mitchell's raison d'etre is necessarily attacking shipping. It's a bomber, isn't it?
Yeah, but the 5th Air Force had, I think, starting somewhere in 1943, starting modifying all these twin-engine bombers. So the A-20, the Boston, and the Havoc in U.S. parlance. And the Mitchell to strafers, so arming them up with a lot of heavy machine guns in the nose or on the side of the fuselage, 12.50 machine guns. So you could strafe Japanese positions. And if you attacked Japanese shipping, either those 12 machine guns destroyed the whole wooden ship, or if they were attacking a Japanese destroyer, the personnel manning the guns, they were really, was better to take cover when the Mitchells attacked. So in this case, they found that barge, and there were four B-25s in the group, in the mission. Barnett saw the barge first, but he was pushed out of the attack pattern And he was last to come in. And he made a crucial mistake. He was too low over the water, and therefore he couldn't really dive on the ship, but he was flying level, so he couldn't really fire into the ship. He was, I think, more or less firing over it. So that gave the Japanese gunners chance to fire back. And they hit him. They hit him in his left engine. He dropped one of his bombs. He had six 100-pound bombs, so not very heavy ones. And that hit the ship midship, destroyed it. But he was hit in the engine and in the rudder cables. And he soon found out he wasn't able to get back to his base in Wakde. And there was only one possibility. He tried to reach the big island of Biak, where there was a U.S. base. But that was flying some 350 kilometers overland to reach it. On one engine, shot up rudder cables, a leaking fuel tank. So he tried, but after, I think, 10 minutes of flying, he realized he couldn't make it. Had he realized that earlier, he could have ditched his plane and waited for a Catalina from the air sea rescue to pick him up. But he was overland, so he had only one option, or two options, either jump by parachute or try to crash land his plane. Well, jumping by parachute is certainly in New Guinea not the best option, because the four crew members would lose sight of each other. They would end up individually with only their personal survival equipment. Yeah, and I think that they wouldn't have survived that. So he decided on a crash landing, saw some open area, thought it was grassland. And when he came in to land, it turned out to be a swamp, a huge sago swamp. I make the comparison to a big American city or in Holland, one of our provinces that big. Yeah, I think maybe, well, name one of the big UK cities that kind of size the swamp is. And he landed in it and did that successfully. At the last moment when gliding, he hit a tree and the plane broke in two, and it threw two of his crew members out in the swamp. But all four survived, and then they were stuck 60 kilometers from shore and 300 kilometers from the nearest Allied base.
I have visions of Star Wars, you know, when Luke Skywalker sat there with his plane in the swamp. Do they have a standard sort of operating procedure? I mean, are they trained for, you know, your planes come, you've been forced to crash land in the jungle, right? This is what you do. Does training kick in, or?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't exactly know. I know they got jungle survival training, but I have no idea how serious these guys took it. I mean, they were all young lads, and they were thinking, well, I'm invincible, I'll return, or whatever. And there was just an Australian army unit starting to give Allied pilots jungle survival training. It was some 15-man strong detachment from the Australian Army that was in Hollandia, the Jungle Training Detachment. So I think they did have some training on that. But in this case, they were very, very fortunate because their air gunner was a very colorful figure, a Native American chief of the Mohegan tribe. And the Mohegan is the tribe that's written about in Last of the Mohicans, that book. So he was the son of the chief, so chief in being, other words. And he had a lot of bushcraft. So he knew exactly what to do when they were stranded in that swamp. And at first, the pilot and the navigator started fighting. Well, shitty pilot to land me here. And the pilot said, well, you shitty navigator to let us land in this swamp. And then Harold Tentaquidgeon, the Native American, stepped in and he took over. And Ira Barnett handed over command to him and said, well, it's now your show from this moment on. And I think they were very fortunate in that. No panic there. And Harold organized everything so they could survive in the swamp. But yeah, the rescue, that was, of course, another story.
Well, the rest of the people he was flying with, do they know where he's come down? Do they know that he was in trouble, or are they just in the middle of nowhere, no one has a clue?
Yeah, they were flying with four, and one of the other planes was also shot up. And of course, most of these formations have plane and wingmen, so two plane formations. So the other two went off to Biak, and they that plane just made the airstrip, crash landed on the airstrip. And Barnett was fortunate in that his wingman had lost him during the attack, but couldn't hear anything. The radio was damaged as well. So he started looking for him, and he, in I think a couple of hours, he found him, or not, cannot be a couple of hours, but within an hour or so, he found him. He knew, of course, that from the position where they attacked the Japanese ship, flying a straight line to Biak, he had to be somewhere in between. And he found him, and he wiggled his wings, yeah, to show them that he'd seen him. And then he flew back to Biak to report that one of the planes was down, and he'd seen a number of the crew walking around the plane.
So Catalina's dispatched. I mean, can a Catalina do anything? I don't suppose a Catalina can land in a swamp, can it?
Yeah. No, there was no Catalina dispatched at that moment because they were in a swamp 60 kilometers from the nearest open water, McClure Gulf. And the nearest biggest river, the Kais River, I think was something like 20 or 30 kilometers. Well, and if you know that you're walking about 500 meters per hour through that swamp, well, you can imagine that going that 20 kilometers, and they shouldn't leave the plane. I mean, there were all supplies there, weapons recognizable from the air. If they went walking, I think they had disappeared in the jungle or in the swamps, so they stayed there. But I think the same day or a day later, their squadron and the 5th Air Force sent out another B-25 looking for them. They found them, and they took pictures of the surrounding area. And they dropped a little note that they found the guys. So they knew they were sighted, and they were told that help was on its way. But what kind of help and how, they didn't really know.
What amused me is that, because they don't have a radio, is the convoluted way that they have to stand on their wings in certain... So one man stand on the wing, this wing, another man stand on that wing, and that means this, and you do this, and... And that's how they communicate with them, because it's a long time before they ever get around to dropping a walkie-talkie.
Yeah. They had something like if you lay flat on the wing and have your arms and legs spread, then there's something happening. And if two of the crew do that, then there are natives or Japanese in the neighborhood. They had indeed such kind of sign language.
It's very clever. So. Do the Allies have, I mean, the Allies, the Americans, do they have teams that extract downed airmen from inland areas?
No, they up till this moment, they really didn't have that. They had an air sea rescue squadron flying Catalinas, the 2nd Air Sea Rescue Squadron, or sorry, Emergency Rescue Squadron. And they had just arrived over there, but they couldn't land in the swamp, of course. And they were instrumental in picking up all kind of aircrew from the ocean, so no problem there. And most of the aircrew that had something, they ditched and then were either picked up or captured by the Japanese. I don't think very many crew landed inland and then were known to have survived. Most were the planes exploded or were shot down, crashed, really crashed. So this was a fairly unique situation. And unfortunately, I haven't been able to find the archives of the 5th Air Force discussing this problem. But I know how they ended up. They made up a team of U.S. Emergency rescue personnel from their headquarters. And they sent message to Hollandia, where that Australian jungle training detachment was stationed, and to bring a number of these guys up to Biak. And because I think, again, it was in Dutch New Guinea, and the locals were used to talking either Dutch or Dutch Malay, they asked for a certain Dutch lieutenant, Louis Rapmund, who'd worked with the Americans before, to join them and to be an interpreter and guide for the team. So they made up a team of 10-12 people. Rapman took a number of Indonesian and Dutch East Indies Army soldiers with him, four Australians, Captain Gillespie, and three NCOs, and two staff sergeants from the Americans. But as there were a fair number of Japanese in the area, they didn't feel really secure. So they asked volunteers from the 41st Infantry Division, American Division, that had just fought a pitched battle with the Japanese on Biak. And incredibly, I think some 300 soldiers volunteered for this crazy mission. And so they took a number of these guys, and Staff Sergeant Victor Krause was their commander. And they brought with them heavy weapons, machine guns, rifles, hand grenades, stuff like that. And they were trained infantry men, so they had those as more or less combat troops with them. So a team of, let's say, 18 strong were then, a couple of days later, early August, flown in by a Catalina to the shore of McClure Gulf and landed near a small village, Kampung Muhadin. And from there, they started organizing the rescue trip.
Did they have any idea how, you know, of the Japanese troops in the area? Do they know what to expect? Do they have any intelligence? I mean, do the Japanese actively go seeking downed airmen?
No, I don't think they actively, unless they landed more or less beside their airbase, something like that. But in this case, I don't even think the Japanese knew a plane had crashed. But ironically enough, there were a lot of Japanese on the coastline because they were survivors from all those ships that were sunk. Every day they sunk tens of those barges in those waters. And mostly, of course, the Japanese troops died in those attacks. But yeah, sometimes they could reach shore and then you had 10, 15, 50, 100 angry and, well, not very well armed, but yeah, capable combat personnel in the area. And if they had some connections with the local Papuans, then they heard about Allied troops in the forest. So Rapmund and the team, they knew it was just a matter of time before the Japanese would hear of them and, well, start acting upon that.
Doing something. So how close can they get to they get the team in onto the crash site?
That's one of the problems I'm still struggling with. We know generally where the crash site is. There were a lot of photos taken during that first reconnaissance end July, early August. But only one of those photos survived, or at least I found only one. But from the reports, I read that there must have been scores of photos taken. And they even draw maps from these photos because they needed a reference, I think, on the river to find the plane, because you sail down the river and at a certain point you say, hey, in this bend of the river we go on shore and then we travel in that direction in the swamp and then we find the plane. And the only picture I have is too much zoomed in, so to speak. I can see the plane and its surroundings, but no reference on a river or whatsoever. So I think it will be some 3 kilometers from the nearest small river, the Sigi River, and they can canoe up some 10, 15 kilometers on the Kais River upstream, yeah, and then have to go into the swamp. But because there are so many Japanese troops reported in the area, Louis Rapmund, who, as far as I can see, is commanding the team, although the Australian army captain has a higher rank. It is a U.S. plane, and there's a U.S. sergeant of the survival team. But I think Louis commanded the team. He decides to split up, and he stays in Kampung Baru, somewhere halfway on the Kais River, to organize a defense. Because if they all go up and the Japanese come, they'll be cut off. And they can't retreat to the ocean. And he stays there with the American combat troops, with Krause and his men. And Mac Gillespie and his Australian sergeants plus an Indonesian interpreter and a guide, and of course a number of Papuans. They go further upstream in 10 canoes, three big ones and 10 small ones, and they paddle up the Kais and then the Sigi River to try and find the crew.
So while they're looking for the crew, Rapamon gets word that there's possibly 100 Japanese heading in his way, so they're vastly outnumbered. You know, it must have been within his purview to think about calling a plane to come and take him out. But they decide to make a stand of it. You know, how do they manage to overcome a determined 100 Japanese troops?
Well, I don't know if they were determined, because I don't know if they really knew that the Americans, the Allies, were there. Because Rapamon had already contacted the local Papuans, and they were, it's difficult to really find out if that it was so, but they were on the hand of the Allies. From the most things I read is that the Papuas didn't really, didn't interest them, whoever was winning the war, as long as they were treated well, and the Japanese were treating them worse than the Allies, so they were in favor of the Allies. But he could speak their language, and he sent down some Papuans in canoes down the river to see if there were any Japanese coming up, and if so, warn him of it. And then he heard about the 100 Japanese coming up in something like 10 canoes or so. And he again sent down that Papua guy to tell the rowers in the canoes, who were also Papuas, to make those 10 canoes spread out over the river. So not coming all in one bunch to the village, but one after another. So that he could overwhelm them individually instead of having 100 Japs at one time. And that worked. So he, together with Krause, he made an ambush with a 30mm machine gun and some riflemen. And when the first Japanese canoe arrived, he let a Papua call to the rowers to row further to the village. At that time, they could order the Japanese to surrender. Well, some of them did, some of them didn't. And then the shooting started, and they killed most of the Japanese and took one or two of them prisoner. And that happened with every canoe that arrived at the village, so they could overwhelm them one by one. Until one of the canoes didn't respond, the people were still sitting in it. And then Rapamon shouted in Malay, jump overboard, to the rowers. The Japanese couldn't understand it. So they were still sitting in the canoe, and all the Papuans were swimming away. And then the machine gun opened fire and killed all the Japanese in the canoe. So that way he defeated those 100 men. There was no one wounded on the Allied side. And he captured a number of them.
It's a remarkable feat, managing to get them to all come in one at a time so you can destroy them in detail. Now, the rescue team, I mean, you talked before about how it's, how slow it is to get through the walk through the jungle. You know, when they get somewhere close to the crash site, how difficult is it to locate the crash site?
Incredibly difficult. They try numerous times to get into the swamp and to locate the wreck of the plane and the crew, and have to turn back three times. And almost are on the verge of giving up. Mac Gillespie even sends back a messenger to Barou saying, well, we can't make it, and we probably will turn back. And then they try a final time. And because of one of the local people tells them that every day an Allied plane is coming over and is circling in a certain area. So they think, hey, that must be our own planes dropping supplies to the crew. So it must be in that area. And they set out in that area. And, well, the first time they get stuck at night. So they sleep in the swamp. And, well, I've been there. It's, in daytime, it's horrible. But I can't imagine having to sleep there at night. I mean, oh, man. Over the mud and the stink and the leeches. And, ah. So they sleep in that horrid environment, and the next day they continue, and then they have a more or less a lucky break as they see the balloon of the emergency radio. The radio itself was damaged, but the Gibson Girl radio that's in a dinghy has a tethered balloon to lift the antenna, and the crew has let the balloon fly so they can see it from about 100 meters away. And then they notice the balloon, and Gillespie fires his rifle three times in the air, and Harold Tentagwijin hears the shots and also fires his service pistol. And then, well, I think it then takes maybe even an hour before they get to the plane. But finally, in the afternoon, they get there, and well, the crew is so very, very happy. They're falling in each other's arms. They'd love to drink some whiskey, but as the expedition was a dry expedition, and I heard from Gillespie's daughter that her father, well, he was Scottish. He liked a wee dram of scotch, but he had to do with tea. They had a tea kettle with him, and they brewed some tea. And then at the end of the afternoon, the rescue team took the crew to back to a native hut to stay the night, and then the next day to the small river, so they could sail down in the canoes to Kampung Baru.
It's amazing that the crew are essentially all fit and well within parameters, aren't they? So they're not as if they've managed to survive their ordeal quite well.
Yeah,
put it that way.
Well, one of the crew was seriously injured when he was thrown from the plane. He cut his leg very deep on the sharp edges of the fuselage that was broken. The others sew him up and threw in some antiseptic stuff. But they were even discussing, if necessary, cutting off the leg. Tentagwijin had a huge Indian Bowie knife, and they were looking at that knife. Does he dare to amputate the leg? And they didn't dare to tell it was the radio operator Pete Wibland. They didn't dare to tell him. Only years after the war, the Tentagwijin told him that he was, if necessary, about to cut off his leg.
I wonder, once a crew's been through an ordeal like that, did they fly again?
Yeah. They at first, of course, they were sent off to some R&R in Australia, and they had a wonderful time in Sydney of it. And then early 44, they flew their required number of combat missions in, I think, starting again in Morotai and then in the Philippines, and then in, I think, all of them, let's say, in spring. Early summer 45, they had the required number of hours flown and were sent back to the States.
You're not sure you really want to go back in a plane after, I suppose, after having to go through something like that. But I guess it could have been a lot worse for them. I imagine the relief of being picked up on the first day and having the regular contact.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That really helped, especially that first note that was dropped by their squadron mates. Yeah, and it has some remarks on it from Ira. If you're happy, wiggle your little bottom to us. And we've confiscated your shoes and all stuff like that to make them laugh, I think. But what you read from their report is that later boredom sets in. They can't leave the plane because the plane is landed in a swamp. And the first supply drop was some 100 meters from the plane. And it took them 3 hours to get to that drop and back. So they didn't leave the plane. So they were on that plane for almost 3 weeks, just sitting there, totally bored, until their squadron mates dropped some books and magazines for them. Just sitting there and trying to catch some frogs for some extra dinner, frog leg dinner. But that's about it. They really bored out of their wits.
Well, it is a remarkable story. Thank you for telling it. Loyal listener, if you want to read the full story, Baz's book is Kais, The True Story of a Daring Rescue of a Bomber Crew from the Swamps of New Guinea. As ever, I will put a link on the website www.podcast.com. For patrons of the podcast, keep an eye out for more of Baz and I chatting about his experiences in New Guinea, tracking down crashed World War II aircraft. It's fascinating. Not a patron and want to hear about Baz's experiences? Head to patreon.com/WW2podcast. Well, that's all from me. For now, I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.